Chapter 3. Eleanor had been living with Greg for exactly 2 weeks to the day, when the Rolls-Royce crunched slowly down the dirt track into the Berrybutt timeshare estate. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the sky was a cloudless turquoise desert. Eleanor and Greg shifted towels, cushions, and drinks out onto the chalet's tiny patio to take advantage of the unseasonable break in the weather. March was usually a regular procession of hot, hard downfalls accompanying a punishing humidity. Greg could remember his parents reminiscing about flurries of snow and hail, but his own childhood memories were of miserable, damp days stretching into May. Fortunately, typhoons hadn't progressed north of Gibraltar yet. "Give it 10 years," said the doomsayer meteorologist. Eleanor stripped down to scarlet polka-dot bikini briefs, a present from Greg when he'd found she couldn't swim, promising to teach her. He rubbed screening oil over her bare back, pleasantly erotic, although the heat stopped them from carrying it any further. They settled down to spy on the birds wading along the softly streaming mudflats at the foot of the sloping clearing. Most months saw some new exotic species arriving at the reservoir, fleeing the chaos storms raging ever more violently around the equatorial zones. The year had already seen several spoonbills and purple herons. Even a cattle egret had put in a couple of appearances. Greg lay on the towel, eyes drooping, letting the sun's warmth soak his limbs, slowly banishing the stiffness with a sensuousness that no massage could possibly match. Eleanor stretched out beside him on her belly and loaded a memox of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings into her cybofax. Every now and then she'd take a sip of orange from a glass filled with crushed ice and scan the shoreline for any additions. Usually the girls he went with would drift away after a couple of days, maybe a week, unable to cope with his mood changes. But this time there hadn't been any. He had nothing to get depressed about. Her body kept the blues at bay. And her humour, too, he admitted to himself. She rarely found fault. Probably a relic of her claustrophobic kibbutz upbringing. You had to learn tolerance there. He wasn't quite sure who was corrupting who. She was sensual and enthusiastic in bed. They screwed like rutty teenagers on speed each night. And he hadn't bothered to see any of his old mates since she moved in. Not that he was pushing them out of his life, but her company seemed to be just as satisfying. It would be nice to think, dream, really, that he could cut himself loose from the pain and obligations that came out of the past. The rest of the country was in an electric state of flux, one he could see stabilizing in a year or two. He had wondered, on odd occasions, if he could manage the transition too. Start to make a permanent home, stick to ordinary cases, earn regular money. There was just so much of the past which would have to be laid to rest first. Whistles and shouts floated down from the back of the chalet row, the estate's kids' 24-hour football game in full swing. Up towards Edith Weston, bright, colourful sails of windsurfers whizzed about energetically. The county canoe team was out in force, enthusiastically working themselves into a collective heatstroke as their podgy coach screamed abuse at them through a bullhorn. Hire boats full of amateur fishermen and their expensive tackle drifted idly in the breeze. Greg hadn't quite nodded off when he heard the car approaching. Eleanor raised herself onto her elbows and pushed her sunglasses up, frowning. "Now that is unreal," she murmured. Greg agreed. The car was old, a 1950s vintage silver Shadow. Its classic, fabulously stylish lines inspiring instant envy. The kind of fanatical devotion invested in both its design and assembly were long-faded memories now, a lost heritage. Astonishingly, it still used the original combustion engine with a recombiner cell grafted on, allowing it to burn petrol. 2 pressure spheres stored its exhaust gas below the chassis, ready for converting back into liquid hydrocarbon when the cell was plugged into a power source. The system was ludicrously expensive. He watched in bemused silence as it drew up outside the chalet, shaming his 2-door electric Fiat Austin Duo. Out of the corner of his eye he could see his neighbours staring in silence at the majestic apparition. Even the football game had stopped. Given the car, the driver came as no surprise. He was decked out in a stiff grey-brown chauffeur's uniform, complete with peaked cap. He didn't bother with the front door, walking round Greg's vegetable patch to the patio, scattering scrawny chickens in his wake. The way he walked gave him the authority. Easy, powerful strides, backed up by wide, powerful shoulders and a deep chest. He was young, mid-twenties, confident and alert. He looked round, curiously, as he approached. Greg sympathized. The little estate had begun to resemble a sort of upmarket hippie commune. Shambolic. Eleanor wrapped a towel around her breasts, knotting it at the side. Greg climbed to his feet, wearily. The chauffeur gave Eleanor a courteous little half-bow, eyes lingering. He caught himself and turned self-consciously to Greg.
"Mr. Mandel."
"Yes?"
"My employer would like to interview you for a job."
"I have a phone."
"He would like to do it in person, and today."
"What sort of job?"
"I have no idea."
The chauffeur reached inside his jacket and pulled out an envelope.
"This is for your time."
It was £2,000 new sterling, in brand new fifties. Greg handed it down to Eleanor, who riffled the crisp plastic notes, staring incredulously.
"Who is your employer?"
he asked the chauffeur.
"He wishes to introduce himself."
Greg shrugged, not that impatient for details. People with money had learned to become circumspect in advertising the fact. Furtiveness was a national habit now. Not even the Second Restoration had changed that. The PSP's local committees had become well-versed at diverting private resources to benefit the community, and they'd made some pretty individualistic interpretations on what constituted community. Greg tried to get a feel from his intuition. Nothing. It was playing coy. And then there was the money. £2,000 just for an interview. Crazy. Eleanor was waiting, her wide eyes slightly troubled. He glanced down at the frayed edges of his sawn-off jeans.
"Have I got time to change first?"
The Rolls-Royce's dinosaur mechanics made even less noise than an electric car. Sublime engineering. There was a glass screen between Greg and the chauffeur, frosty roses etched around the edges. It stayed up for the whole drive, leaving questions stillborn. He sank into the generous leather cushioning of the rear seat and watched the world go by through somber, smoked windows. Chilly air conditioning made him glad of the light suit he was wearing. They drove through Edith Weston and onto the A1, heading south. The big car's wheelbase bridged the minor roads completely. Over a decade of neglect by the PSP had allowed grass and speedwells to spread out from the curbs. Spongy moss formed a continuous emerald strip where the white lines used to be. It was only thanks to farm traffic and bicycles that the roads had been kept open at all during the depth of the dark years. Horses and cyclists pulled onto the verge to let them pass, curious faces gaping at the outlandish relic. The impulse to give a royal wave was virtually irresistible. There was some traffic on the dual carriageway A1. Horse-drawn drays, electric cars, and small methane-fueled vans. The Rolls-Royce outpaced them effortlessly, its suspension gliding evenly over the deep ruts of crumbling tarmac. The northbound side of the Wetland Bridge had collapsed, leaving behind a row of crumbling concrete pillars leaning at a precarious angle out of the fast-moving muddy water, pregnant from 5 weeks of heavy rains. The bridge had been swept away 4 years ago in the annual flooding, which had long since scoured the valley clean of all its villages and forms. During the dry season, the river shrank back to its usual level, exposing a livid gash of grey-blue clay, speckled with bricks and shattered roofing timbers, the seam of a serpentine swamp stretching from the fringe of the Fens Basin right back to Barrowden. The chauffeur turned off the A1 at Wansford, heading west, inland, away from the bleak salt marshes which festered across the floor of the Nene Valley below the bridge. Greg hated the waste. President Armstrong's legacy. It was all so unnecessary. Levees were amongst the oldest type of civil engineering. The rolls turned off onto a dirt track. It looked like an ordinary farm path across the fields of baby sugarcane, leading to a small wood of Spanish oaks, about 3/4 of a kilometre away. There wasn't even a gate, simply a wide cattle grid and a weather-beaten sign warning would-be trespassers of dire consequences. The chauffeur stopped before the grid and flicked a switch on the dash before driving on. There was nothing between the metal strips, no weeds, puddles, only a drowning blackness. They drove through an opening in the trees, under a big stone arch with wrought iron gates, kept in excellent condition. Stone griffins looked down at the rolls with lichen-pocked eyes. There was a long gravel drive beyond the gates, leading up to a magnificent early 18th-century manor house. Silver windows flashed fractured sunbeams. A tangle of pink and yellow roses boiled over the stonework, tendrils lapping the second-story windowsills. 5 dove-grey geodesic globes lurked amongst the forest of tall chimney stacks, very heavy-duty satellite antennas. The rolls pulled up to a smooth halt level with the grey stone portico.
Willem Manor,
the chauffeur announced, gravel-voiced, as he opened the door. A couple of gardeners were tending the regimented flower beds along the edge of the gravel, stopping to watch as Greg stepped out. Something was moving in the thick shrubbery at the foot of the lawn. Dark. Indistinct. Bigger than a dog, slipping through the flower-laden plumbago clumps with serpentine grace. Spooky. Greg reached out with his esper sense, detecting a single thread of thought. Diamond hard. He placed it straight away. An identification loaded with associated memories he'd prefer to forego. He was focused on a gene-tailored sentinel panther. It padded along its patrol pattern with robotic precision, bioware arch senses alert for any transgressors. He sucked in his breath, stomach muscles clenched. The jihad legions had used similar animals in Turkey, a quantum leap upwards from modified Rottweilers. He'd seen a sentinel take out a fully armored squaddie after the animal had been blown half to bits, jaws cutting clean through the boy's combat suit. They were fucking lethal. The manor's elegant facade suddenly seemed dimmer, fog-bound. He was shown through the double doors into the hall by an old man in a butler's tailcoat. The interior was as immaculate as he'd expected. Large, dark oil landscapes hung on the walls. The antique furniture was delicate to the point of effete. Chandeliers like miniature galaxies illuminated a vaulting ceiling, a decor which blended perfectly with the building. But it was all new, superimposed on the ancient shell by a stage dresser with an unlimited budget. The paint was glossy bright, the green and gold wallpaper fresh, the carpets unworn. Greg hadn't known this kind of opulence existed in England anymore. Yes, his usual clients were well off, but at most that meant a detached house with maybe 3 or 4 bedrooms, or some overseas-financed condominium apartment loaded with pieces of family heritage saved from the magpie acquisition fever of tax office apparatchiks. Given normal circumstances, the local PSP committee would have turned the manor into accommodation modules for about 40 families, who'd then work the surrounding land in some sort of communal farm arrangement, either a co-op or a fully-fledged kibbutz. Willem's renovation was recent, post-second restoration. The butler led Greg up a broad, curving stair to the landing, and he caught a glimpse of the formal gardens at the back. Bushes clipped into animal shapes, centred wide paths. A statue of Venus in the middle of the lily pond sent a white plume of water shooting high into the sky. Spherical rainbows shimmered inside the cloud of descending spray. The inevitable swimming pool was a large oval affair, a good 20 metres long. A tall tower of diving boards stood guard over the deep end, and there was a convoluted slide zigzagging along one side. A couple of big inflatable balls were floating on the surface. Three teenagers cavorted about in the clear water. Two girls, one boy. They seemed out of place. Interlopers. Their lively shrieks and splashes, discordant with the funereal solemnity that hung through the rest of the manor. He was shown into Willem's oak-panelled study, and the day finally began to pull together into some sort of sense. Philip Evans was waiting for him. There had been this girl. Greg couldn't remember her name now, but the two of them had got rapturously drunk watching the coronation together. The triumph of the Second Restoration remained forever buried in that alcoholic Netherland. But he distinctly remembered Philip Evans sitting in the Abbey's congregation. The cameras couldn't keep off him. A small man in his mid-70s, stiff-backed, using a stick to assist his slow walk, but managing to smile brightly nonetheless. Philip Evans was the PSP's bête noire. Their Whitehall media department set him up as a hate figure, a campaign of vilification which left Orwell's Emmanuel Goldstein standing. It had backfired on them badly. Evans became a romantic pirate to the rest of the country, a living legend. Event horizons, cybernetic factories, floated with blissful impunity in international waters, churning out millions of counterfeit gear systems every year. Molecular-perfect Korean flat screens, French Memox crystal players, Brazilian cybofaxes, a long, long list of the consumer goodies which R&D-starved state factories couldn't match, and PSP economic policy prohibited importing. His fleet of stealth transports made nightly flights over England, distributing their wares to a countrywide network of spivs like demonic Santas. They proved unstoppable. One of the PSP's first acts on reaching office had been to disband most of the RAF. The black market gear hurt the economy badly, undermining indigenous industries, turning more people to the spivs. A nasty downward spiral, picking up speed. Evans had changed for the worse in the intervening 2 years since the coronation. The flesh sagged on his face, becoming pasty white, highlighting dark panda circles around his eyes. His hair had nearly gone. The few wisps remaining were a pale silver. And not even the baggy sleeves of his silk dressing gown could disguise how disturbingly thin his arms were. He was sitting at the head of a long oak table. Two hollow cubes flanked him. Multicolored reflections from their swirling graphics rippled like S-bend rainbows off the highly polished wood. Greg sniffed the cool, dry air. There was a tart smell in the study. Peppery. Philip Evans was badly ill. The aging billionaire dismissed his butler with an impatient flick of his hand.
"Come in, Mandel. Can't see you properly from here, boy. My bastard eyes are going along with the rest of me."
There was another man in the study, standing staring out of the window, hands clasped behind his back. He didn't look round. Walking down the length of the table, Greg saw that Evans was only whole above the waist. His legs and hips had been swallowed by the seamless cylindrical base of a pearl-white power chair, torso fusing into an elastic chrome collar. It was a mobile life support unit, analog BioWare organs sustaining the faltering body. But the mind was still fully active, burning hot and bright. Greg shook his hand. It was like holding a glove filled with hot water.
"What do they call you, boy? Greg, isn't it?"
The accent was pure Lincolnshire, blunt, as much an attitude as a speech pattern.
"Yes, sir."
"Well, I'm Philip, Greg. Now sit down. It wricks my neck craning up at you."
Greg sat, one chair down from Evans.
"This is my security chief, Morgan Walshaw."
The man turned, looking at Greg. He was in his late 50s with close-cropped grey hair, wearing a blue office suit, plain fuchsia tie. Shoulders squared. Definitely ex-military. The recognition was instantaneous. A mirror. Eyeing each other up like prize fighters, Greg thought. Stupid.
"Mr. Walshaw doesn't approve of my asking you here,"
Evans explained.
"I don't disapprove," Walshaw said quickly. "I just consider this an internal affair.
Sorry, nothing personal." Greg looked to Evans, politeness software loaded and running, showing respect.
"May I ask you why you chose me in particular for a job? Random selection is frankly unbelievable."
"Haven't decided whether you are going to do a job for me yet, boy. You'll have to prove you're what I'm looking for first. I believe you cleared up a problem for Simon White last year. Delicate. A real ball-crusher. That right?"
"I know, Mr. White, yes."
"All right, don't go all starchy on me. I do business with Simon, he recommended you. Said you only work for the top man. Keep your mouth shut afterwards, right?"
"That's correct," Greg said. "Naturally, I offer confidentiality, but in taking on corporate cases, I do so only for the board or chairman. Office politics are a complication I can do without."
"You mean I couldn't hire you?" Walshaw asked.
"Only if the chairman approved."
"Your ex-army?" the security chief persisted. "Mine star?"
"Yes."
"So it was the army which gave you your gland," Evans said. "How come you didn't sign on with the Combinate security division after you were demobbed? Or even turn tech merc?"
"I had other things to do, sir."
"You could have earned a fortune."
"Not really," Greg said. "The idea that gland physics are some kind of superbreed is pure tabloid. If you want someone who can see through brick walls, then I'm not your man. Glands are not an exact science. I tested out psi-positive with top marks on ESP, so the army volunteered me for an implant thinking I would develop a sixth sense that could pinpoint enemy locations, index their weapons and ammunition stocks, but the workings of the mind don't follow a straight logical course. I was one of the disappointments, along with several hundred others. People like me were one of the major factors in the decision to abandon the MindStar program, and that was long before the PSP obliterated the defense budget."
"So, what can you do?"
Evans asked.
"Basically, I can tell if you're lying. It's a kind of super-empathy or intuition, a little mix of the two. Not much call for that on the battlefield. Bullets rarely lie."
"Don't run yourself down, boy. Sounds like you've got the kind of thing I'm looking for. So, tell me, did I enjoy my breakfast orange?"
Greg saw the gland, glistening ebony, pumping. Physically, it was a horrendously complex patchwork of neurosecretory cells. The original matrix had taken the American DARPA office over a decade to develop. An endocrine node implanted in the cortex, raiding the bloodstream for chemicals and disgorging a witch's brew of neurohormones in return. The answer was intuitive.
"You didn't have orange for breakfast."
Morgan Walshaw blinked, interest awakened. Evans grunted gruff approval.
"The last quarter profits from my orbital Memox crystal furnaces have been bad. True or false?"
"They've been awful."
"You ain't bloody kidding, boy."
The chair backed out from the table and trundled over to a window. Gazing mournfully across the splendid lawns, the billionaire said,
"This job isn't for my benefit. I suppose you know I'm dying."
"I guessed it was pretty serious."
"Lymph disorder, boy. Aggravated by using the old devil deal hormone to keep my skin thick and my hair growing. So much for vanity. Serves me right. This thing I've got, very rare, so they tell me. After all, it would never do for me to die of something common."
He snorted contemptuously at his own bitterness.
"Everything will go to my granddaughter, Julia. She's the one out there in the pool, the brunette. The lovely one."
"What about her parents? Don't they stand to inherit?"
"Ha! Call them parents, because like buggery I do, if I hadn't paid off her mother, she'd still be in that Midwest cult commune, smoking pot and screwing its leaders for Jesus. And that son of mine is incapable of taking on Event Horizon. Couldn't, anyway, even if he wanted. Legally incompetent. Best detox clinics in the world have tried to straighten his kinks. Too late." He's been on Syntho so long, and I'm talking decades. The dependence is unbreakable. You cold turkey his body and the lights go out. They shoved him through the whole routine. Counseling, group analysis, deprivation, motivation, work therapy. It amounted to one great big zero. The only time he even knows there's an outside world is when he's tripping.
The anger rose again.
It's fucking humiliating. I was prepared for some rebellion, a bit of antagonism between us. That's the way it always is between father and son. But him, we had nothing. No love, not even hate. It was like everything I was achieving didn't even register with him. He walked out the door on his 20th birthday, and that was it. Not another word for 25 years. The only reason I found out I had a granddaughter was because that freako cult he wound up with tried to leech me for donations. That's why I've got to safeguard the company. For her. I'm not going to last for much longer. And she doesn't have the experience to take it on right away.
But surely you'll be leaving Event Horizon in the hands of trustees, Greg asked. People you know can manage it properly.
Damn right!
There was a fierce spark of elation in Philip Evans's mind.
Event Horizon has the potential to become a global leader in gear manufacture, while other land-bound English companies rotted under the PSP's intervention. I bought in new cyber-production equipment for my factory ships, kept my overseas research people well-funded. Now I'm moving it all back home, consolidating. The company's growth potential is phenomenal. It'll create jobs, foreign exchange, build and sustain a national supply industry, stop the sink back into an agrarian economy. We can match those bloody German combinates and the best the Pacific Rim market can offer. New economic superpower, my ass. I'll show 'em England isn't dead yet.
Sounds good. So why do you need me?
Evans scowled.
Sorry, I run on. Old man's disease. By the time you accumulate the resources to accomplish something worthwhile, time's up. The problem, boy, is my orbital operation up at Xanthus. Someone is running a spoiler against the company. They've turned the operators of my micro-G furnaces up at Xanthus. 37% of my Memox crystals are being deliberately ruined. That adds up to 7 million euro francs a month.
Greg let out an involuntary whistle. He hadn't known Event Horizon was that big.
Yeah, right,
Philip Evans said.
I can't sustain that kind of loss for much longer. Lucky I caught it when I did.
And there was a hint of pride at the accomplishment. Still on the ball. Still the man.
The organizers circumvented some pretty elaborate security safeguards, too. Means whoever they are, they're smart and organized.
They're clever, all right, Walshaw conceded. He pulled out a black wood chair opposite Greg and sat down.
And even the security division is under suspicion,
Evans said,
including Morgan here, which is why he's so pissed off with me.
Greg sneaked a glance at Walshaw. Meeting impenetrable urbanity, the man had not, nor ever would, sell out. Greg knew him, the type, his motivation. He'd no grand visions of his own. The perfect lieutenant, and in Event Horizon and Philip Evans, he'd found an ideal liege. The old billionaire must have understood that, too. Walshaw nodded an extremely reluctant acknowledgement.
The nature of the circumvention does imply a degree of internal complicity. Certain knowledge of the security monitor procedures was compromised. He means the buggers are on the take, that's what,
Evans grumbled.
And I want you to root 'em out for me, boy. You're about the nearest thing to independent in this brain-wrecked world. Trustworthy, as far as we can satisfy ourselves. So then, 400 new sterling a day, and all the expenses you can spend. How does that sound?
Do I have to sign the contract in blood?
Just don't screw me about, boy. I spent close on 20 years fighting that shit President Armstrong and his lefty stormtroops. Now he's gone, I'm not going to lose by default. Event Horizon is going to be my memorial, the trailblazer of England's industrial renaissance.
Greg felt a twinge of admiration for the old man. He was dying, yet he was still making plans, dreaming. Not many could do that.
"Where do you want me to start?" he asked.
"You and I will go down to Stansted," Morgan Warshaw said. "Assuming I'm trustworthy."
"Don't be so bloody sarcastic,"
Evans barked. "Stansted is Event Horizon's main air freight terminal in England," Warshaw explained, quietly amused. "All our flights out to Listowel originate there."
"Listowel?" Greg asked.
"That's the anchorage for my cyber factory ships out in the Atlantic," Philip Evans said. "A lot of Event Horizon's domestic gear is still built out there, and it's where my space line, Dragonflight, is based. Anyone going up to Xanthus starts at Listowel."
"Calling in the management personnel and Meemox furnace operators who are currently on leave won't be regarded as particularly unusual," Warshaw said. "Once they arrive, you can use your gland ability to determine which of them have been turned. After that, you and a small security team will go up to Xanthus and pull whoever circumvented the security monitors, along with the guilty furnace operators working up there. We'll fly up replacements from the batch you've vetted."
"You want me to go up to Xanthus?" Greg asked.
There was a sensation in his gut, as if he'd just knocked back a few brandies in rapid-fire succession.
"That's right, boy."
"Why?"
"No problem."
"No," Greg grinned. "No problem at all."
"It's not a bloody holiday," Evans snapped. "You get your ass up there and you stop them, Greg. Hard and fast. I've got to have something concrete to show my backing consortium. They're due for the figures in another 6 weeks. I've got to have something positive for them. They'll understand a spoiler. God knows enough of the combinates are trying to throttle each other rather than do an honest day's work. What they won't stand for is me dallying around whinging instead of stomping on it."
Philip Evans subsided, resting on the power chair's tall back.
"That just leaves this evening."
"What's happening this evening?" Greg asked.
"I'm throwing a small dinner party. Some close friends and associates, one or two glams, plus Julia's house guests. There's a couple of people I want you to screen for me. I've invited Dr. Ranasfari. He's leading one of Event Horizon's research teams, a genuine genius. I've got him working on a project I consider absolutely crucial to my plans for the company's future. So you, handle with care."
Evans stopped, looking as uncomfortable as Greg had yet seen him. For a moment he thought it was the illness, but the old man's mind was flushed with an emotion verging on guilt. Warshaw had turned away, uninterested. Diplomatic.
"The second?"
Philip Evans nodded vaguely at the window.
"That lad out there. Adrian, I think his name is. Julia seems quite taken with him. Leastways, she doesn't talk of hardly anything else. Don't get me wrong, I don't object to him, not if he makes her happy. Nothing I want more than to see her smiling. She's my world. It's just that I don't want her hurt. Now, I know you can't expect eternal commitment, not at that age, and he seems pleasant enough, but make sure she's not just another tick in his stud diary. Life's going to be tough enough for her, being my heir. She surely doesn't deserve bad news boyfriends as well."